You're well? Not so bad, can't complain. Good. So, hoping you guys have fished out a Bible, you've begged, borrowed, or stolen one. I've ordered some more church Bibles. I forgot to say that to you, Graham. Is that okay? Great. It's a brave treasurer who says the minister can't buy more church Bibles. Shout out to Alan and Jean. They sent me a lovely email saying they wouldn't be here again this week, but they're looking forward to the podcast. So should we say a good day to them? One, two, three.
Good day.
There we go. We miss you. Good day, Sheila. Really? We miss you, Alan and Jean. Come back soon, but not tanned. Okay, so what we're going to do this morning, we're going to preach together. So I'm going to be 2 minutes, and the rest of you are going to be the rest of the hour. We're going to be thinking about a story that you know really well, and we're going to do it a little bit differently because I think we may have missed some of the points in David and Goliath. I know we know the story, but I think there's some things we could look at. So if you've got your Bibles, we're looking at 1 Samuel chapter 17. I want to do a little bit of a catch-up so far. Of where we got to. I want to keep, when we talk, we just open the Bible in the middle of 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel is before 2 Samuel, if you can't find it. It's near the beginning. So we're looking at about 1050 BC. That's the sort of timeline we're looking at. The people of Israel are not really a people of Israel at all. They're a loose collection of tribes. And they come together every now and then they kind of coalesce around a leader to fight off the enemy. And then when they're fought off the enemy, they then go their separate ways again, pretty much. And there are judges that have done that. Samuel was the last judge, the leader that all rose to the top. And as he gets older, as Samuel gets older, he appoints his sons who weren't like him. They were lazy and crooked. And the elders gathered and said, "We want a king." We talked about this a couple of weeks ago and how important that is in the story of the people of God. We want a king, like the other nations, the kind of brave warrior king who would lead us into battle. We know God's our king. We want one we can see and touch and feel and pay homage to. And that broke Samuel's heart. And remember, we looked to 1 Samuel 8, is it, where God says, "They haven't rejected you, Samuel, they've rejected me." Because they want to have their own king. And even the Lord warns them, "Are you sure you want a king? Because the king will take your best men to be your warriors, your best girls to be his wives or his servants, the best animals for himself, the best crops. Are you sure you want a king?" And they said, "No, we know all that, but we want a king." So God chose the king, and the king's name was Saul. And that was about 1046 BC when Saul was chosen king. Now, what was he like? Because in your mind, you're thinking Alan Rickman, aren't you? Yeah? You think, aren't you? When you think of Saul, you think Alan Rickman. Am I right or am I wrong? Yeah, no wrong. Who are you thinking of, John? Who's Alan Rickman? That's what you're thinking, aren't you? Never heard of him. Okay. Go back and Google him. Not now, unless you've got your app open. But those who know Alan Rickman, you know, you are, aren't you? Yeah, okay. Thanks, Mum. Okay. But actually, what do we know about Saul? Anyone remember from Sunday school days? What do you know about him? He was very tall. And what else? He was handsome. He was a dish. He said, "Well, you've got to think not Mr. Bean, but Sean Bean here, okay? This guy is strong, he's got a six-pack, he's ripped, he is head and shoulders, it says, above the others." And that's the kind of king you want, isn't it? Arrogant, a Lord of the Rings kind of king. The one that's strong and brave and will lead the people into battle, and that's what they got in Saul. They were delighted. And it started really well and then went off the rails. This is the bit, this is all like last week, this is all the stuff we've looked at briefly before. He was Alexander the Great, Genghis Khan, a Vikings kind of character. I've been watching the Vikings this week, seen that on Amazon Prime. See that? It's great. It's 1 Samuel, but in Norway. You should watch this stuff. It's amazing. All part of my sermon preparation. It starts off really well with Saul, and then it goes off the rails. Let me show you why. Because he becomes king about 30, and he reigns for 42 years. So he's 72. And they save you the mass when he stops being king. And he becomes like the other kings who take things for themselves. And I want you just to see 1 Samuel 13. We'll go back to 13 for a minute. After a battle, Samuel says, "You've not kept the command your Lord gave you. Had you kept it, the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom must end. For the Lord has sought out a man after his own heart. The Lord has already appointed him to be the leader of his people because you've not kept the king's command." And you can look back in over lunch and look and see what happened with Philistia and the Philistines and Saul's disobedience. So from almost right at the beginning, Saul is rejected. But how many years did he reign for? 42. So for most of his reign, he is rejected. And that's why you often read about Saul's paranoia. And very often when you read about Saul, you can see him sitting against the wall with his star, with his sword, spear nearby. He's in the mafia seat. He's sitting where he can see everybody with a spear nearby. So anyone, I do this in cafe. I sit where I can see the whole room. Do you do that in a restaurant? Okay, maybe it's just me. But it's the mafia seat. You've got to sit where you can see folk and where you can see a clock. That's why the preacher's clock that's always slow is up there. Saul became mad. He became deluded. He was tormented. And he always sat with his back against the wall with his spear ready. He, for 40 years, he ruled like that. Paranoid that God had rejected him and that someone was coming behind him. That someone, of course, was David. Now, his final nail in the coffin for Saul was against the Amalekites. They united together to fight the Amalekites. And if you look in chapter 15 of Samuel, you'll see something which will make you feel a bit queasy. Verse 3, this is what Samuel says to Saul. "Go and completely destroy the entire Amalekite nation. Men, women, children, babies, cattle, sheep, goats, camels, and donkeys. This is the word of the Lord." It's tough, isn't it? This is genocide in the name of God. "Go and destroy all of it." But he doesn't. He keeps the best stuff for himself, which is what any sensible king would do. And if you look further down, verse 13. "When Samuel finally found Saul, Saul greeted him cheerfully. 'May the Lord bless you. I've carried out the Lord's commands.' 'Then what is all the bleating of sheep and goats and the lowing of cattle I hear?'" Ah, now I may have kept the best for myself, and I'll offer some of it to the Lord. This is my interpretation as we go on through the story. But more or less, I've carried out the Lord's command. Now, we're going to come up time and again when we get into David's life with this whole violence. We can't get away from it without sort of dancing around and reinterpreting the scriptures. Pretty horrible things happen in these books. But God is dragging a nation to be the light to other nations. And it may seem strange or unsightly or ungainly to modern ears, but these spoils of war would be very typical. This kind of ancient Near East practice was very typical. But God was wanting to be their king and to treat them differently, that they might treat others differently. And so that's why it's saying, destroy them completely. You're to have no trophies. And it sounds bloody and violent, and it's both those things. But so God's name can be honoured. He is the one king, and not you keeping the spoils of war. God specifically told them to destroy everything, and he didn't. And so it's like a Yahweh war, as theologians call it. It was sanctioned by Yahweh. This is what one writer says. The Yahweh war functioned where Yahweh was commander-in-chief, even above the human military leader, and the result was guaranteed by Yahweh, regardless of the size of the opposing human forces, or in some cases, whether the Israelites had to even fight at all. These were enemies of Yahweh, not just enemies of the tribes of Israel. And that's important as we go through, and we'll keep coming back to that. I don't want to dodge a bullet on that. This violence thing is a theme that we'll keep coming back to and trying to get our heads around. Not to glory or to delight in the violence or keep the spoils of war, abusing those you've captured, destroy everything. And he doesn't. And that's one. That was the final nail in Saul's coffin. Now, this is just an introduction, by the way. So, anyway, we know David is then anointed. We did that a couple of weeks ago. Saul doesn't know about this. He's going to know about it. And he becomes paranoid and mad. It haunts him for 30 years that the Spirit of God has been taken from him. And so they send for someone to play the music for him, to keep him cool, calm and collected, and that spear away from his hand. And who do they send for? David. Okay, if only he'd known. So, David and Goliath. Now, I did have this kind of idea that we would put the chairs differently, but I know that makes you a little bit nervous. And we'd have, like, the two sides. We'd have, like, Philistines. Anyway. So, here is a picture here of the location of the Valley of Elah. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to read through the scripture. And I want us to think about some of the verses. I'm going to stop and make notes, and we're going to point out some things, and we're going to have a little conversation. And then I'm going to just do a little bit about how do we start bridging the context between this world and our world. And then we're going to finish the sermon off together. Is that okay? Good. I shouldn't keep asking you questions that you can say no to, should I? Okay, so we're going to wander through the story. So the Philistines were now mustered their army for battle. I'm in 1 Samuel 17, in case I didn't say that. Sorry, 1 Samuel 17. The Philistines now mustered their army for battle and camped between Socah in Judah and Azekah at Ephes-Damin. Okay? You see the Valley of Elah there. See that in green? Okay. This is what it looks like now, by the way. It looks a bit different. But you can imagine, can't you? Let's assume that this sort of side is where the Philistines were, and the further hill was where the Israelites are, and the valley's in the middle. That farm's going to get a shock, isn't it? But that's where it is today. That's what it looks like today. Okay, thanks. Back to the map. Saul countered by gathering his Israelite troops near the Valley of Elah. So the Philistines and Israelites faced each other on opposite hills with the valley between them. Okay, you can get the image, can't you? Come on then, they're all weaponed up. They're ready to go. They're going to have a battle. It's what they expect. And then Goliath, a Philistine champion from Gath. You see Gath there? One of the five cities of the Philistia. Gath is here. So he was a local boy. He came out of the Philistine ranks to face the forces of Israel. He was over 9 feet tall. He wore a bronze helmet, and his bronze coat of mail weighed 125 pounds. He also wore bronze leg armor, and he carried a bronze javelin on his shoulder. The shaft of his spear was as heavy and thick as a weaver's beam. But the two before was his spear, and it was tipped with an iron spearhead that weighed 15 pounds. His armor bearer walked ahead of him, carrying a shield. So this guy is enormous, enormous. And he's got some serious armor, some serious bling on. With all those weights, they know how much it weighed because they killed him. Spoiler alert. And they can work out from having weighed it themselves. But every time I read this, I read it lots of times this week, I kept thinking about the armor bearer. The guy going in front of him, carrying a shield. What was his walk like, I thought to myself. Come on then, I've got him behind me, I'm safe, or if I'm in the between him and them, then I'm in trouble. Was he kind of like cowering, or was he like, yes, yes, like the Gruffalo standing behind him? I don't know. You can decide yourselves. So here he is. This monster comes along. Goliath stood and shouted a taunt across the ears to the Israelites. Why are you all coming out to fight? He called. I am the Philistine champion, but you are only the servants of Saul. Choose one man to come down here and fight me. If he kills me, then we will be your slaves. But if I kill him, you will be our slaves. I defy the armies of Israel today. Send me a man who will fight me. Now, I almost to title this message, The Bravery of Goliath. Because this is substitutionary sacrificial atonement. For those who know, this is what Jesus does. This is what the ram on the mountain did with Abraham. Goliath saying, there's no need for you all to die. He can see the armies. He knows what's behind him. I'll be one sacrifice for you all. You send a guy, I send a guy. Whoever wins, we'll call him the winner. Winner takes all, and we can save all this bloodshed. That's courage, isn't it? That's a different sermon for another day. Just occurred to me.
And what happens? When Saul and the Israelites heard this, they were terrified and deeply shaken. Now, if you were Saul, think for a minute, why were you terrified and deeply shaken? So he is the tallest man of the Philistines. Who's the tallest man of the Israelites? And he is the king they wanted to lead them in battle. And he's thinking, I don't fancy this. I'd rather take my chances with a whole army fight, wouldn't I? This one-on-one stuff, I'm going to lose. This guy is enormous. He's enormous. Now, David was the son of a man named Jesse, an Ephrathite from Bethlehem in the land of Judah, in case you weren't paying attention last chapter. Jesse was an old man at that time, and he had 8 sons. Jesse's 3 oldest sons, Eliab, Abinadab, and Shimeah, had already joined Saul's army to fight the Philistines. David was the youngest son. David's 3 oldest brothers stayed with Saul's army, but David went back and forth so he could help his father with the sheep in Bethlehem. For 40 days, every morning and evening, the Philistine champion strutted in front of the Israelite army. Okay, 40 days. Whether it was 40 days or lots of days. Morning and evening. Right, let's do it. Get your armour on. Keep your powder... No, they didn't have powder, did they? Get your powder dry. Get your rifles ready. Get your spears out. Get it all sorted. We're going to go and fight the Philistines. They go down and then Goliath steps out. One of you against one of us. Let's do this. And they run back terrified. Morning and evening for 40 days or for a long time. Now, you could do that once and say, okay, we need to think about this a bit. Who's going to be? Well, Saul's the tallest, but he's the king and he's a bit of a scaredy cat. But let's do it again. Get your armour on. Keep your powder dry. Get your rifles ready. Let's go do this. Philistines get there too. Goliath comes out. One of you against one of me. Let's do this. And they run back terrified. After a while, morale's going to start ebbing away, isn't it? Every time they're terrified. Maybe it wasn't as bad as... Maybe he wasn't that big. Maybe it's just the way the light was shining on his bronze armour. Maybe that's why he looked so enormous. No, he really is that big. Let's go back and think again. They're crumbling. Morale is ebbing away. They're crumbling. One day, Jesse said to David, back on the farm, take this basket of roasted grain and these 10 loaves of bread and carry them quickly to your brothers and give these 10 cuts of cheese to their captain. See how your brothers are getting on and bring back a report on how they're doing. David's brothers were with Saul and the Israelite army at the Valley of Elah, fighting against the Philistines. So David left the sheep with another shepherd and set out early the next morning with the gifts as Jesse had directed him. He arrived at the camp just as the Israelite army were leaving for the battlefield and shouting with shouts and battle cries. Soon the Israelite and Philistine forces stood facing each other, like they had done, army against army. David left the things with the keeper of supplies and hurried out to the ranks to greet his brothers. As he was talking with them, Goliath, the Philistine champion from Gath, came out from the Philistine ranks. Then David heard him shout his usual taunt to the army of Israel. As soon as the Israelite army saw him, they began to run away in fright. Maybe by now he was like making faces as well. You, I'll take you. But they're running away in fright after days of this. Have you seen the giant? The men asked. He comes out each day to defy Israel. The king has offered a huge reward to anyone who kills him. He will give that man one of his daughters for a wife, and the man's entire family will be exempt from paying taxes. David says, what did he say? He said what? He'll give us what? He asked the soldiers, what will a man get for killing the Philistine and ending his defiance of Israel? Who is this pagan Philistine anyway? Whether he's allowed to defy the armies of the living God? And these men gave David the same reply. They said, yes, that's the reward for killing him. There's going to be a reward. And the reward's going to be one of the king's daughters, a princess. And your whole family is going to be tax-free for the rest of their lives. He said, what? And 3 times in this story, David said, what did he say? He said, one of the wives and tax-free. Why is he... Is he deaf? Is he stupid? He can't believe it. And this is the first time it says in the story, because he's defying the God of Israel. That's what on David's heart. He understands that actually, never mind the wife, or never mind the money, this is the right thing to do. He's defying the Lord our God, the God of Israel. We need to go fight him, regardless of the other rewards there might be. And even with those other rewards, no one is brave enough to fight. And these usual taunts carry on. And then you get this younger brother, older brother thing going on. But when David's oldest brother, Eliab, heard David talking to the men, he was angry. What are you doing here anyway? He demanded. What about those few sheep you're supposed to be taking care of? I know about your pride and deceit. You just want to see the battle. What have I done now? David replied. I was only asking a question. You can hear the tone, can't you? Leave me alone. He walked over to some others and asked them the same thing. What did he say, the king? He'll give us what? And then David's question was reported to King Saul, and Saul sent for him. Don't worry about the Philistine, David told Saul. I'll go fight him. And here the whole story starts changing. I'll fight him. David is not the guy from the Mr. Muscle advert. He's not skinny and tiny. He's not just brave and stupid. He's a shepherd that has got a previous very good track record. He's not just idealistic and has the courage. He has the faith to take on what is clearly an assault on the name of the Lord his God. There's no way you can fight this Philistine, Saul said, and possibly win. You're only a boy, and he's been a man of war since his youth. But David persisted. I've been taking care of my father's sheep and goats, he said. When a lion or a bear comes to steal a lamb from the flock, I'll go after it with a club and rescue the lamb from its mouth. And if the animal turns on me, I catch it by the jaw and club it to death. I've done this to both lions and bears, and I'll do it to this pagan Philistine too, for he defied the armies of the living God. Have you taken on and killed a lion with your bare hands? No. Not many people have. Think for a minute while I get some water. Who has, in the Bible, you can remember, has taken on a lion? Samson, good memory. Anybody else? Well, Daniel, he just kind of like stayed in the corner and prayed hard, didn't he? Benaiah. Very obscurely, Benaiah. And 2 Samuel 23, a bit further on, you can see that he takes on. He says, Benaiah did many heroic deeds, which included killing two champions of Moab. And one time on a snowy day, he chased a lion down into the pit and killed it. So David did that too. Three. He's in good company. He's not the Mr. Muscle Weedy man. He's brave and able. And he has been offended on behalf of the Lord his God. He's up for it. He'll go and do it. He could be the bravest man in the whole Israelite army. He may be the most, not just the bravest, but also the most able to go out. He has the faith and the ability to go sort this. And anyway, the battle's not mine, it is the Lord's. So Saul finally consented. What a chicken. The biggest, tallest, handsomest guy in Israel, the king of all the land, says, okay, shepherd boy, you go see what you can do. I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll give you my armor, and may the Lord be with you, because you are going to need it. So he puts on the armor, a bronze helmet and a coat of mail. David put it on, strapped his sword over it, and could hardly walk. I put in my notes, it'd be like Wendy trying to put on my football kit. It's, I can't go in these, he protested. I'm not used to them. So David took them off again. And then what did he do? Now you know this verse off by heart. He picked up 5 smooth stones, put them in his pouch, and went off to meet the giant. Okay, have you got time for an aside? You know how by Tuesday my mind's wandering on anyway? And I'm thinking to myself, 5 small stones. Now this guy is he's got his catapult. It's not like one that you do when you're fishing with bait. It's like a leather thong that you can get going. I could never do it. Swing it round and round and round. It's about 3 foot long. Are you imagining this? With a stone in the end, you flick it at the right moment, and the stone travels about 150 miles an hour. I mean, this is going to kill you if it hits you. And he's good at this. How many giants are there? One. How many stones are there? Five. So he's thinking, the more stones I take, the more chances I get the guy on the ground, right? Or maybe I miss. What would you do? Maybe he's gift-aided there, that's why I've taken a few extra. And then as you kind of like reading around, I've been reading the whole of 1 and 2 Samuel. Just indulge me for a minute. 2 Samuel 21. Now this is right at the end of David's life. Look at verse 15. Battles against Philistine giants. Once again, the Philistines were at war with Israel. And when David and his men were in the thick of battle, David became weak and exhausted. He was an old man now. Ishbi Benob was a descendant of the giants. His bronze spearhead, always sounds familiar, weighed more than 7 pounds, and he was armed with a new sword. He had concerned David and was about to kill him. Oh, cornered. It's some new glasses. Cornered David and was about to kill him. But Abishai, son of Zeruiah, came to David's rescue and killed the Philistine. Then David's men declared, "You're not going out to battle with us again. Why risk snuffing out the light of Israel?" After this, there was another battle against Philistines at Gob. As they fought, Sibbekai from Hushah killed Saph, another descendant of the giants. During another battle at Gob, Elhahunu, sorry, it's on two pages, I can't put it together. That guy, son of Jair from Bethlehem, killed the brother of Goliath, of Gath. The handle of his spear was as thick as a weaver's beam. In another battle with the Philistines at Gath, they encountered a huge man with 6 fingers on each hand and 6 toes on each foot. 24 in all. You haven't got to the math, it's all here. Who was also a descendant of the giants. But when he defied and taunted Israel, he was killed by Jonathan, the son of David's brother, Shimeah. These 4 Philistines were descendants of the giants of Gath, but David and his warriors killed them. Now, I wonder, this is something for you to talk about after tea. Could it be that as David goes down the valley to sort out the giant, in his peripheral vision, he's thinking, those 4 guys are pretty big too. They would have been there as well. And maybe he's thinking, I might not need 1 stone, I might need 5. Because if I kill him, the rest will be coming soon after him. I don't know, but it's just a thought for later. Anyway, back to the story. So, 17:41, chapter 17, verse 41. You still with me? Goliath walked out towards David with his shield bearer, however he was walking, I think a little bit more confidently, when he saw David. He said, yeah, we can tackle him, can't we, Goliath? Sneering in contempt at this ruddy-faced boy. Am I a dog? He roared at David, that you come at me with a stick. And he cursed David by the names of his gods. Come over here, and I will give your flesh to the birds and wild animals. In brackets, I won't even bury you. Let the dogs eat you, Goliath yelled. David replied to the Philistine, you come to me with sword, spear, and javelin. But I come to you in the name of the Lord of heaven's armies, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. Today, the Lord will conquer you, and I will kill you and cut off your ugly head. And then I will give the dead bodies of your men to the birds and wild animals, and the whole world will know there is a God in Israel. Okay, suddenly we're feeling a bit more pumped, aren't we? How is he going to cut his head off? He hasn't even got a sword with him. We'll come to that in a moment. And everyone assembled here will know that the Lord rescues his people, but not with sword and spear. This is the Lord's battle, and he will give you to us. Okay. And I wonder what the brothers are thinking. That's David. David's gone. What are we going to tell Dad? He came to bring us some cheese and some bread, and suddenly he's down there fighting.
Terrified. But David strides out. But as Goliath moved closer to attack, David quickly ran to meet him. He doesn't entrench himself, embrace himself. He runs to him. Come on then, let's do this. He goes in courage. He's brave. He's in the Lord's hands. He reaches into his shepherd's bag and, taking out a stone, he hurled it with a sling and hit the Philistine in the forehead. The stone sank in and Goliath stumbled and fell face down on the ground. The stone doesn't kill him. So David triumphed over the Philistine with only a sling and a stone, for he had no sword. Then David ran over and pulled Goliath's sword from his sheath. David used it to kill him and cut off his ugly head. This is the word of the Lord. Now, he takes the head, puts it in the knapsack, and goes, says, here you go, Saul, this is what you're after, a head. And keeps the sword for himself, which, if you know the story, saves him later. We'll come to that. He gets saved by the sword later on. Okay, let's go. Let's leave the story there, because we can go on. It's very exciting, this. It's a bit bloody, but it's very exciting. But let's also remember that a lot of the TV that a lot of us watch has also got a lot of blood and gore in it as well. This is real life, isn't it? This is like, it's not as sanitised as Silent Witness, but it's along a similar kind of line, isn't it? There are lots of dismembering and all kinds of things happening, some of it even in Brighton, judging by the last Silent Witness that we were watching. So we got this story, and what it's really about is the rise of the Lord's anointed, David, and the demise of the Lord's rejected, Saul. The one who brings a sling to a sword fight, who says the battle's not ours, it's the Lord's. And because you defy the God, the only true God, today you will die. It's a real story of faith. Now, what I want to do before you finish the sermon off, I want us to think a little bit about hermeneutics, which is not some sort of disease or anything. It's the way we interpret things, the way we interpret scripture, the questions we ask when we're reading the story. And one of the problems with stories like this, it makes a great story. And I remember this vividly as a kid, being told this as I got my Moses sticker in my little card in Sunday school. I don't know why I got a Moses sticker, but it was always the Old Testament guys. And you told this story, and you have Goliaths too. And I'm thinking, not 9 feet tall ones. And it's really easy to spiritualize this. And we'll ask some questions of it. But I want us to be careful, because the obvious, this is that. We have to be very careful interpreting scripture in that way. Sometimes it can be helpful, but usually not. And it's a very normal evangelical hermeneutic. David had a sling. Folks, you need to go and buy a sling. David got Goliath and he chopped his ugly head off. You find your Goliath and chop their ugly heads off. That's the this is that hermeneutic. I'm being a bit facetious, but you know what I mean. That you read it and you do it. Love the Lord your God, we understand that. And a lot more of the New Testament is easy to do that with. Love your enemies. Got enemies? Yes, love them. That's a this is that. That works. But when it comes to Goliath, we don't have any 9 feet tall guys who are square and want to kill us. I don't think. No? Okay. So we've got to be very careful when we just apply it. We live in different days. We're living in a very different day with very different issues. And these were violent times. This is the times of the Game of Thrones, the Vikings, the violent times. Now, we live in violent times too, but is it talking about the violence, or is it talking about different things? Another thing we need to think about is, are you David? I hope this is not going to disappoint you, but no, you're not. This is great King David. Now, you're all lovely people, but you're not King David. He was a special guy. I remember I was telling someone this week, one of the lecturers used to say, this is not, when I was at Bible college, this is not the story of everyday country folk. This is exceptional. This is an exceptional story. And our lives are not this like this, are they? I don't think we meet many giants in our way. This is not our, we've got to be careful to say, David did this, we do that. So we've got to say, well then what's it there for? What is it in the Bible? What's it trying to teach us? This is the proper hermeneutic. And two of the questions that are really helpful for me when I think about this is, what does the story do? What does it do? What does it do to us? Does it give us a confidence or question what we think?
And what does it really, what is this, what does it do for us? And what's it there for? Why is it being recorded? And what does it mean for us in that way? So these are really important questions, because the context of all this, and this is why I started the way I did, I know I've been more than 2 minutes, but the context is kingship. And we mustn't lose that. And so for us to say there are things in our lives, and I've got some giants in my lives. They're not 9 feet tall and covered in bronze, but I've got some pretty big challenges. You have too, haven't you? But the question is this about that? I don't think it is. Now, it's true that we can fight these challenges and we can overcome them in Jesus' name, but that's not what this story is really about. Now, that's not a traditional interpretation. I get that. I can judge by some of your faces, you're thinking, what? You can't spoil this too. But in the context of kingship, what does this story really teach us? So we're going to spend like 2 minutes talking to the person next to you, think coming up with some kind of cunning plan, because I have no more notes. Do you want to see? There's nothing there. That's not true. I've got 6 words, which might rescue us at the end. So of all that you've heard, what does this sermon do? What does this passage do for us? What does it make us feel? What comes out of it for us? And don't just jump to, I need to be a better person, love my neighbours and love God. But what's it here for? What is the passage trying to tell us about what's happening in these times? And what could it possibly be saying to us too? Now, we're feeling our way with this. I'm not expecting, you know, amazingly profound answers. We're trying to together to discover what this might be saying to us. So have a chat with the folk next to you. We'll get some feedback in a moment. But don't worry about thinking out loud, because that's all I do all the time. And it's just fine. I'd rather you think about it than get whatever is a right answer, if there is even one right answer. So just a couple of minutes, the people around you, and then we'll see what we can come up with.